There are thousands of names on the UW-Madison list of experts, but if you go one step further and query labor union experts, one name comes up. Associate History Professor William Powell Jones, who's joined me for a discussion of the major events of the last month in Madison. Professor, thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Those of us that have been in the Capitol day in, day out for a month, we don't have the ability. We're busy, you know, meeting deadlines and coping with protesters, going to governor's press conferences, going to legislators' press conference. We lose the big perspective. So help us understand, what history was made in Wisconsin here in the last month? Give us a first of the 10,000-foot overview, please.
Okay. Well, I look at this on two levels. One is the sort of broader national historic trends that I think this plays into, and then the specifics of Wisconsin's collective bargaining law, which I think is also a very important sort of local history that has very important national ramifications. So in terms of the national trends, I see both the changes to collective bargaining laws and the broader budget bill that that the Senate and the Assembly is still debating in terms of a shift that I think a number of historians have seen from social policies that are largely informed by the legacy of the New Deal. So these are policies that aim to decrease economic inequality and social inequality through tax policies, through the provision of social services. And I think toward a set of policies that some historians and others have associated with the legacy of the Gilded Age. And some people have argued that we are entering something of a second Gilded Age. And I think what's really at stake here is the way in which we understand the role that the state plays, the government plays in society and in the economy. And if we think about the legacy of the New Deal, I think the assumption was that the government plays an important role in stimulating economic growth and shaping the distribution of wealth. Whereas I think the policies that we're seeing increasingly, and I think these budget policies and these collective bargaining policies are moving in the direction of seeing the state as an impediment to economic growth, and so sort of shrinking the state as something that's good for society. So that's sort of the broader macro. I think in terms of the specifics of the collective bargaining bill, which is, I think, in terms of the perhaps the thing that's most specific to Wisconsin here, I mean, we have the oldest statewide collective bargaining law for public employees.
Passed in 1959.
That was passed in 1959.
But that was for the local employees. Then we added employees, was it about 10 or 11 years later?
That's right. So it's been gradually increased to cover state employees. And it's a, you know, the bill, the law itself treats different levels of employees and different types of employees in different ways. It's a pretty complex law. But I think there's really three major lessons that, or perhaps historical inaccuracies that I've noticed in this debate about collective bargaining. One is the idea that public employee unions are relatively new and they've been created by these laws, like the 59 law. I saw Senator Scott Fitzgerald argue that the unions, actually public employee unions, were created in the 1970s. So there's this idea that they have a very short history, which is not really accurate. The public employee unions go back to the 1880s, as old as the American Federation of Labor. The largest public employee union in the nation is AFSCME, which was founded in Madison by Wisconsin state employees in 1932.
So in 1932?
That's right. So that's actually before
founded in Madison.
In Madison.
As AFSCME, American Federation.
It was originally the Wisconsin State Employees Association.
Okay.
But it became AFSCME when it affiliated with the American Federation of
Labor. So it started here, only blocks from our Capitol.
Just down the hill is the first headquarters is still standing on West Washington Avenue.
And it started in the state of Wisconsin because of our past.
Well, there were a number of reasons for why it began in Madison. One has to do with the fact that Madison has been, since the 1890s, a laboratory for social policy, particularly social policy related to labor. So workplace safety laws, social security laws,
unemployment compensation.
I mean, we could go a long list of policies that
progressive income tax.
That's right. And so the sort of expertise in Madison, both at the university and at the state level, created an environment in which people were looking at ways to deal with labor conflicts, both in the public sector and the private sector. AFSCME was actually founded primarily by a group of workers in the civil service system who were concerned that the civil service system was not able to deal with some of the problems that were evident in the 1930s. Okay. So I think it's important to keep in mind that, you know, so AFSCME was older than the United Auto Workers, the United Steel Workers, I mean, the major industrial unions that that grew up later in the 1930s actually, you know, came after AFSCME. So these unions have a very long history. They were not created by the laws. They existed before, and they'll continue to exist, you know, whatever happens to the law. I think the law is very important, and that's another sort of aspect of the history that's not been brought up in this.
So your first point is that Wisconsin has a long tradition, and anybody who says we've only had public employee unions for the state workers is wrong, because it goes back a long way.
That's
than
right.
That.
Yeah.
Okay, and then you were going to make two other points before I interrupted you.
No, that's the other has to do with the effect that the law has had. And one misconception, I think, is that the law has benefited public employees at the expense of private sector employees. And if you look at the way in which the law was written in the first place, it was actually designed to do just the opposite. The perception was that private sector employees had collective bargaining rights and had labor protections that had allowed them to create a certain amount of economic security for themselves, and public employees did not have that. And if you look at the trend, has actually been over time that these laws have created some level of parity between public sector and private sector employees, not this perception that I think is widely held that public employees have something that private sector employees do not have. So I think that's another misconception. The final one is the perception that these laws have created, have sort of bloated public employment and created inefficiency in the public sector,
yes.
Which again is really exactly the opposite of what the laws were designed to do and what the effect they've had. I mean, in Wisconsin, we have a very small civil service. We have an extremely efficient one that provides a high level of service for very little money. And that is not direct, you know, not only related to the collective bargaining laws, but collective bargaining laws have created a situation that favors efficiency, that favors workers with experience and training in these systems, and also creates a rational system for dealing with labor conflicts that are going to be there, right? Mm-hmm. So there's always going to be conflict over wages and benefits, mm-hmm. and this creates a legal system to deal with those rather than dealing with them through strikes, which are extremely expensive and disruptive for public services.
Well, now what about in the last few decades? The numbers that I've been reading, trying to catch up on some of these issues, is the number of private sector employees in unions dramatically dropped off. Is it fair to say then that the number of government employees who are in unions has gone up, or is it leveled off? Mm-hmm. How about those two different trends, sir?
Well, last year we reached a point where where public employees were the majority of unionized workers in this country for the first time in history. That occurred about a year ago.
That's a major development, isn't it?
That's a very important development.
And that's part of the reason that our new Governor Walker and the GOP, his strong majorities in both the Senate and the Assembly, saw a window of opportunity here, sir?
Right. And it's also, I think, a reason why the criticism and the of public employees, I think, has gained ground. I think people look around and they say, well, these people have things that I don't have. They belong to a union. They have the protection of a union, and I don't have that. They have health benefits and a very generous retirement program that I don't have. And I think that's been, you know, a central factor in these debates. I guess as a historian, I would take a number of ways of looking at that. One is the fact that all of these benefits, health programs, retirement benefits, living wages, are benefits that are very closely related to the ability to negotiate, largely due to unionization. Mm-hmm. So those benefits, usually the idea that a worker can go to work and get health plan, for example, is really an invention of the union movement and something that unions pushed for initially in the private sector, and actually spurred the movement of unionization in the public sector. So public employees looked at private sector employees and said, "Hey, I want some of what they have." Right. So what's happened in the past 30 years has been a very sharp decline in unionization rates in the private sector.
Yes, sir.
And there's a number of reasons for that. There's been a concerted effort to scale back enforcement of public sector union laws. So, for example, it's very easy for an employer to fire somebody when they are involved in a union campaign. Very difficult for a worker to appeal that. And mm-hmm. so the law is there. The legal protections are there, but they're very rarely and very inconsistently enforced. There's also the pattern of that's been going on for at least 50 years of factories moving overseas, and that the sort of threat of unionization, that if you unionize, we'll move overseas, or if you don't give these concessions. And so as people have seen their standards of living in the private sector decline, you know, I think it's understandable that there's a level of resentment against people who have a greater ability to protect what they have, largely because they belong to unions.
And Governor Walker put it in very simple terms. He said right now, public employees and their benefit levels, all these issues, health care, pensions, conversions of unused sick leave, that has made them the haves.
Right.
And those that don't work for government are the have-nots. Now, that's very striking, harsh rhetoric.
It is. I mean, I think an important part of that is to really look at the numbers. And it's true that if you look across the board and you combine wages and benefits packages, so total compensation, public employees across the board tend to make slightly more than workers in the private sector.
Okay.
Now, it's important to keep in mind a few important details to that. Public sector workers in Wisconsin are about twice as likely to hold a college degree as workers in the private sector. And I think many people would argue and agree that it's fair to pay somebody more if they have a college degree than if they do not, right? So if you correct for education, public employees actually make far less in terms of total compensation, so their wages and their benefits combined, than similar workers. So if you compare somebody who has a college degree in the private sector, they're going to make more than somebody with a college degree in the public sector.
Right.
And so I think, while on one hand, in terms of the ability to form unions, the ability to negotiate, public employees do have some sort of effective rights. The rights are there and legally enforced. I think largely because it would be unseemly for public officials to go and break unions and mm-hmm. to violate union laws in the way that, quite frankly, private sector employees do quite routinely.
On February 11th, when the governor announced the scope of the changes that he wanted, let's dial back collective bargaining for public employees except to wages and then cap those at CPI.
Right.
Let's make unions have to hold recertification votes with everybody, not just the union members, annually. Let's make dues payable to unions optional. Were you surprised at the scope of his changes?
I was very surprised. I mean, partially, you know, we talked about this earlier, the rhetoric in the campaign, which was that public employees have to, you know, give up some of their benefits and their wages. There was never any discussion of changes to the legal rights of public employees. So on the surface, I was surprised. But I guess the way I see these laws, knowing about the way in which unions operate, these are laws that are clearly designed to make it impossible to belong to a union and to form a union and for a union to operate. In that sense, I was very surprised. I mean, the idea that you would require somebody to win an election with 50% of all the people eligible to vote. I mean, let's remember that that we had in the last governor's election, we had 50% turnout, and the governor won
52%.
Half of that. So the governor was elected with roughly 25% of the eligible vote. So I don't think if we held any statewide election to the standard of that you have to win 50% of the eligible vote, I don't think anybody would ever win. I think, you know, it's an undemocratic way. I mean, that is not majority rule, right? It says if you stay home, your vote is counted against the union. Is it in effect?
And so you were surprised at what the governor was asking for and what he signed, what he eventually got.
He did. I was also surprised by his contention that these were minor changes. I mean, these were dramatic. In my reading of the law, these changes effectively reverse the intention of the law. I mean, if you read that law, it says one thing it says is that. That the law is written on the understanding that three parties have an interest in creating a system of collective bargaining. Those three parties are public employees, the public officials, mm-hmm. and the public itself. Mm-hmm. Right. So the argument was that this law is designed to help the public by creating a rational and an orderly system for handling labor disputes, for avoiding strikes and other conflicts. My sense is that the way in which the law has been revised is to completely invalidate that central argument. That was really, that's the first line of this, the way in which the law.
But you and I have read the commentaries in The Columnist who have said, when a public employee union sits down with an employer who's also a public official, there's no incentive to protect the taxpayer. How do you feel about that?
Well, you know, I think one thing is that from the very beginning, the laws governing collective bargaining in the public sector have recognized that public employee labor relations is not the same as private employee labor relations. So from the very beginning, that's why public employees were excluded from the National Labor Relations Act, which covers labor relations in the private sector. That's why a quote that I've seen a lot of in the past few weeks has been President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's view on public employee unions, in which he said very clearly that collective bargaining cannot operate in the public sector the way it operates in the private sector. So this is a different situation, and the laws are actually designed to take that into account. One example of that is that in the private sector, the National Labor Relations Act gives private employees the right to strike mm-hmm. and the right to hold on to their jobs during a strike. So it's illegal to fire somebody for going while they're on strike. Public employees in Wisconsin do not have that right, and they've never had the right to strike. And that is an important recognition of the fact that the what's at stake is different, that there's a difference. Public employees have access to a mediation system that is designed to mediate these conflicts without leading to a strike.
To a strike.
And those were explicitly written into the law in exchange for the prohibition on striking. So the argument was, we recognize this is a different situation and we're going to create a different avenue for resolving these things. So on one hand, I think, you know, it was widely recognized when this law was passed by the 1959 law,
yes,
that this was a different situation. And labor relations experts, public officials across the country weighed in on this, that this is that this cannot operate the way that labor relations operates in the private sector.
One thing that intrigued me and I want to ask you about, Governor Walker put out the scope of what he wanted on February 11th. The TAs then marched that next Monday. Mm-hmm. I think that would be the 14th. Mm-hmm. But it quickly became a fight that he took on the whole House of Labor, even though he exempted police officers and firefighters. Mm-hmm. But quickly, within days, it became a fight over the House of Labor. Were you surprised at the way private sector unions embraced it? You may have seen some of the protests. There were two huge Teamster semi-trucks,
yeah.
Boilermakers trucks. I was getting emails saying, when you list private sector unions, be sure to note that Teamsters, AFL-CIO, International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, we're all here.
Mm-hmm.
Were you surprised that it became such unity in the House of Labor?
I was. I think there's, in hindsight, I think there's a number of reasons for that. One is that the lines between public and private employment are not always clear. And so, for example, Teamsters often represent public employees. I mean, you know, graduate students at a number of state universities are organized by the United Auto Workers. So, those lines have blended a little bit. And there's a lot of largely public
grad students on some public university, UAW?
Yep, by the UAW, right. So that, you know, I mean, so those lines are not complete, and to that degree, a lot of sort of industrial unions, private sector unions, have a stake in this as well. Another thing I think is actually something that is true of the particularly true of the union movement in Wisconsin, where they've actually made an effort to build ties between public sector and private sector unions, and to emphasize coming largely from the leadership of the state AFL-CIO and local labor federations, to emphasize the commonality and the common bonds. And that's something that I didn't know about before this, and I was really surprised to see that level of sort of feeling a common bond. I think also the unions, the firefighters and the police that are not directly affected by this, have played a really prominent role.
They made it their own fight.
They have.
And there were
yeah.
color guards with firefighters and bagpipes marching through the Capitol. Some of that still rings in your ears weeks later. So were you surprised that the firefighters and the police officers didn't say, not our fight because we're exempted?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't sure how that would play out. I mean, in some respects, I think you can understand why they would understand this as, well, it's not directly targeting them.
Maybe
they
next
may
time
next.
At them, and, maybe the next time.
I think that's much easier to see than, you know, somebody working in a paper plant who is covered by federal labor law. You know, the governor of Wisconsin and the Wisconsin legislature doesn't really have the ability to remove their collective bargaining rights. But I think a firefighter, you know, could see, you know, they're not coming for me now, but they could come for me.
What about the idea that I've heard the governor and Senator Fitzgerald express that the protest, even though it drew 700,000-800,000 people over the course of a month, was largely a Dane County phenomenon. And if you take this issue out to northern Wisconsin, the governor wins. The governor's right. Do you think this was a Dane County phenomenon? The old idea of Madison is, you know, 77 square miles surrounded by reality? Or was it indeed a statewide and national and world-watched fight?
Well, it's clearly one that was watched around the world and around the country. I think to a certain extent this has disrupted a common sort of political divide in the state that has, you know, sort of been Madison against the rest of the state. Now, I think, you know, certainly part of the size of the demonstrations has to do with the fact that they happen in Madison, a place where there is a large, you know, sort of liberal population. It's also, you know, it's the state capital, and so it provided a sort of focal point, I think, for people. So many people were coming from other communities across the state. And I think that was really essential especially for unions, their ability to build these mass demonstrations was to actually have the ability to bring people from smaller towns in the north and across the state. On the other hand, I think what we've seen, particularly since the bill has passed, is that unions have made a concerted effort to, I think, decenter Madison from these protests. So you've seen very large protests in Green Bay, a number of cities across the country. This yesterday, I believe, the governor was confronted by a huge demonstration. It was Brown County maybe a couple days ago, and then yesterday there was another one.
He went to Green Bay and Eau Claire and La Crosse yesterday.
Maybe it was in, I don't remember where it was, but, you know, the governor has clearly been, these demonstrations have clearly followed the governor around the state. And I think part of it has to do with the degree to which, it's one thing to talk about state employees, who many of whom live in Madison and work in Madison, but if you start talking about teachers, that's across the, you know, it's in every community, obviously every community, hospital workers who, you know, are healthcare workers who are living in every community. Also, I think one dynamic that's driven this is the degree to which many working class and middle class families rely on the benefits that one member of the family comes in, right? So you may have a family where one member of the family that works in the private sector and maybe is a small business owner, but does not have health care benefits and a pension. Mm-hmm. And then another member of the family who's a school teacher or a nurse who probably doesn't earn a lot in terms of their salary, but has health care benefits and pensions. And so I think that's actually created a dynamic that I didn't anticipate, and I suspect that the that that the governor did not anticipate this as well, which is that many people who don't have a direct stake in this, or you know, on the surface, actually do have a stake in this.
Do you think this fuse will stay lit? In other words, when you and I sit down a year from now, will there still be demonstrators picketing Governor Walker when he goes out state and pretty much any and all appearances?
Right. Well, I think that's very hard to predict. I think it has a lot to do with the ways in which I think on both sides of respond to this in the future. I think the governor has certainly sort of inspired these protests by his unwillingness to negotiate and to sort of stake a position and not back off of it from the beginning. I think the governor has a lot of opportunity in the next few weeks and months to take a very different position that I think would make him seem more reasonable and I think maybe deflate some of the anger that has driven these protests. So I think that could be a dynamic that we'll see. I think that on the side of unions, I think it will be, I think it's a question as to how unions can maintain this.
I was going to ask you that. What's the future of AFSCME and SEIU and AFT? Where do you think they're going to be 1 year from now? Well, a lot less money?
Certainly, yeah.
I mean, the governor invited members of these unions to stop paying dues and use this to pay some of your additional health care and pension costs.
Right, right.
That's a pretty naked invite for our governor to deliver, isn't it? I mean, how are these public employee unions going to fare, do you believe?
Well, I don't think it bodes well for them. I mean, I think these laws were clearly designed to get rid of unions in the public sector. And the way in which they will pretty much constantly be having to run recertification elections. They have to run certification elections every year. Apparently, there are 2,000 collective bargaining units in the state of Wisconsin.
Yes.
And you can imagine just the bureaucratic nightmare involved in running an election in every single one of those every year. It's going to make it difficult on the part of the state. It's going to tax the resources of the state, but it's also going to make it very difficult for unions. And they're going to be running these campaigns all the time. They're going to be renegotiating contracts every year, which is extremely expensive and costly. And they really don't have much they can give to their members, right? They can't negotiate over benefits. They can't. They can only negotiate over wages as long as those wages don't rise above the
CPI,
the consumer price index.
Or you
index.
Have to go to a referendum to exceed CPI.
So there's not
pretty
a lot.
Pretty stringent.
They have to work very hard to maintain their membership, and there's not much they can deliver. I think that if unions maintain a very high level of activity, they will perhaps be able to survive long enough to change the political dynamic in the state and maybe overturn these laws. I think that's a really critical question in the next year or so. If they don't do that, I think we see a very rapid decline.
Do you look for a lot of the national unions to begin pouring money into some of these potential recalls of our state senators?
I don't know what the I don't know what the legal dynamics of their sort of national unions getting involved in campaign contributions.
Or all of these potential 16 votes to toss out some of our current senators.
Are those
becoming nationalized?
Oh, I know that unions nationally are looking at this. They're also looking at what's happening in Indiana and Ohio and other states.
Did this 5 years ago,
right?
And did it with a lot less anger, passion, and trauma. Mm-hmm. Do you know enough about how it works in Indiana?
I'm not completely comfortable talking about the dynamics
understand.
In Indiana. But I think it is interesting that the way in which it blew up here. I mean, unions in Wisconsin are much stronger and have a much stronger history here than in Indiana. And I think that has a lot to do with it.
We've
the,
had some
response.
Very healthy strikes and fights, haven't we, over our
We have. I mean, going back over 100 years.
That picture that the New York Times that quoted you, the strike-bound Alice Chalmers plant in Milwaukee area in 1946, where the protesters are draped over the hood of a vehicle. So
right.
Wisconsin is always pretty good dialogue and fight over union issues, right? It's not a It's not something that we've run away from.
That's right. I think probably a lot of your listeners are familiar with the Bayview, the events in Bayview in 1886.
And the Hortonville teacher strike.
The Hortonville teacher strike, the Kohler strike, actually two very, very sort of conflicts in Kohler that gained national attention. And I think part of that has to do with the fact that Wisconsin has always been sort of on the cutting edge of labor rights and the sort of debates over labor relations. Unions have had the ability to shape public discourse in Wisconsin in ways that have that have made it a flashpoint, I think, for, you know, since the 1880s.
Well, maybe one final question is this. As a scholar looking at the history of union movement, and you worked up a book on public employee unions, haven't had a chance to sell it yet, maybe you can now. Well, but as a scholar, what are you going to be looking for in the next 6 months in Wisconsin in light of Governor Walker signing this major change into law?
Well, you're right, yeah. I have been doing this research on this book, and up until fairly recently, there wasn't a broad interest in public employee unions, so it's interesting to see it now. I think, I guess things that we can look to, I think that this will have a profound impact on the union movement in Wisconsin, and I think nationally, and so that will be an interesting way. I think I see it could either be a continuation of this trend that I think we've seen in a decline in unionization rates. You know, we've seen that decline in the public sector and in the private sector, and I could see that taking off really in the public sector as well, which I think would reinforce this trend toward greater economic inequality in the country, mm-hmm. and also a trend toward viewing the state as something that is not a contributor to economic growth, which I think is a reversal of the way in which policymakers at the national and the state level have seen it for almost 100 years.
And you're not surprised at anything you saw unfolding in the Capitol over the last month?
Oh, I've been surprised repeatedly. I was surprised by this law. I didn't expect it to happen in this way, and I was also surprised by the reaction to the law. I don't think anybody anticipated that we'd be seeing these protests. That, you know, I don't know if they've occurred on this scale in Wisconsin ever before.
And probably.
I think it's a historic event. It's been very interesting to watch it from very close up.
From all of our standpoints.
That's right.
Well, you may want to tweak your book and on public employee unions and get it out there, because it's a lot more timely now.
Yep.
Professor Will Jones, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you very much for having
talking
me.
Talking about the history that we've made here.
I've enjoyed it very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.